The following audio is brought to you by Emmanuel Baptist Church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. More information about our church can be found at emmanueltuscaloosa.org.
So, something a little different tonight. This is the last meeting of the year. So, you know, when we come back in January, we're going to be looking at the book of James. And so, I was thinking about, what do I do with tonight? Because there's only one, then we're going to be off for 2 weeks, and then we're going to come back, and I don't want to start James only to then come back and have to remind you of what we did when we started James. So I thought we'd just do a one-off of something that I thought would be fun. So the design tonight really is to think about Christmas and the Christmas traditions that we have and where they came from. There is a lot of times when you get around this time of year, you find different people making different claims about Christmas and some of the Christmas traditions. And sometimes you'll hear every once in a while, maybe you've never heard this, I don't know, but sometimes you'll hear people making arguments that the Christmas traditions, like cutting down a tree and bringing it into your house, and December 25th itself, and all of these have kind of pagan origins, and maybe even making the argument that Christians shouldn't celebrate that. Now, my contention tonight is not to quibble over holidays and to say how one has to celebrate one thing or how one has to do another thing as far as traditions in your home and any of that kind of stuff. It's not about any of that. Really, it was just about saying, well, why don't we look at where these came from and why we even do these things and why they're even a part of the church. We have a tree in our church right now. What is our intention with that? And you know, why are these things here, and why do we do that? And I thought it would be interesting to do and to just look at a little bit of history, a little bit of church history, as far as we can tell. And maybe if you're like, oh, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't do this, you know, then maybe it might put your mind at ease or not. I don't know. So I thought about doing this in two different sections, taking some of our Christmas traditions and looking at where they came from and why Christians have adopted these things. And then the other part of it is really thinking about the Christmas story itself, and some significant events that are happening there, and kind of tie, hopefully, these two things together. So with this first section, December 25th, Christmas trees, and did Santa Claus punch a heretic? I'm going to look at just some of these things that we've come to practice over the years. So first of all, December 25th, where does that even come from as a holiday? The earliest evidence for celebrating Christ's birth, at least why the church started doing this anyway, comes from Rome in the mid-4th century. And we get this in this little calendar that had made its way around, and it's sort of they call it the Philocalian calendar. And it was published in 354 A.D., which means that everything on it was well into circulation and practice. So this calendar is basically reflecting all of the main holidays and traditions that were celebrated up until that point. And so on that calendar, we see December 25th listed as the Nativity. And so it is the practice of the church, at least in Rome, initially, by 354 and a little bit certainly before, to celebrate Christ's birth on December 25th. And now a lot of, there are some, here's where some kind of mix comes in. You know, you'll have a calendar, you probably on your calendar, you flip through and you'll have all the little holidays that'll kind of pre-mark all the holidays. That's essentially what this calendar is. So it's telling us that well before 354, Christians in Rome are celebrating the Nativity. Now, Christmas does not make its way around the world with great speed. It takes a good deal of time to actually make its way out of Rome. Christians in Rome are certainly celebrating Christmas on December 25th, on and before 354. They think at least by 336, Christians are doing that. Now, it has become kind of a common claim that Christmas came about because there was a pagan holiday around that time that Christians sought to kind of go, hey, you converts to Christianity that don't want to give up your celebration around Christmas, we'll just celebrate Christmas, the birth of Christ, on December 25th and kind of co-opt the pagan holiday so that you don't have to leave some of your old traditions, but you can kind of rebrand them. If you've ever seen the t-shirt that has the Coca-Cola font that says Jesus Christ, sort of like that, you know, like we're kind of making our new Christian tradition out of an old pagan holiday. And it doesn't seem that that's actually the case. In fact, you'll see some critics that have suggested that Christians chose December 25th to counter the Roman cult of what's called Sol Invictus, or the unconquered sun, which is the S-U-N, sun, which was a celebration that was established sometime around 274 AD in the Roman Empire. And then there's a particular holiday that was celebrated just shortly after Sol Invictus called Saturnalia, and that occurred on December 17th. Saturnalia was on December 17th. Sol Invictus was just shortly after Saturnalia. Saturnalia is a celebration of basically the pagan god Saturn. And both of these celebrated in Rome. But the problem is, Sol Invictus, we don't have evidence that they celebrated that on December 25th until very late. In fact, on the calendar, the same calendar that we just looked at a minute ago, the Philocalian calendar, lists both of those holidays, the Nativity and Sol Invictus, on the 25th. And so it seems as though these were basically two different celebrations that were independently practiced, and there's no seems to be correlation between the two, or even any co-opting of any holiday by Christians, for that matter. There, no Christians ever, even in history, as early as they even talk about Christmas, talk about a pagan holiday at all. And what seems to be the case is that a lot of Christianity has taken over Rome, and a lot of the pagan celebrations have worked their way out, that very few people are even celebrating these festivals during that time. But then, how do we know that Christians are not really trying to co-opt this pagan celebration and actually use it for Christmas? Well, it's because how they argue for Christmas's celebration, for the reason we would celebrate Christmas. Because when you think about it, how did we get to the 25th of December if it wasn't because we were celebrating this pagan holiday? Early Christians believed that for like redemptive figures in history, people who were like prophets and very important people and things like this, that these great redemptive figures were conceived on the same day they died. So you might think about it like Christians considering God by the calendar to be pointing to a particular figure and saying, this is how you know this figure is really important. He died on the same day he was conceived. That sounds foreign to us. It sounds really weird, I think. But this was kind of a commonly held belief. And so it's God's way of signifying someone meaningful in history. And when people began to think about Christ's death, they started to see the death and his conception as related to one another. And in particular because, well, there was also some other traditions around his birth that sort of made its way around at that time too, which seemed to give credence to this idea. So the thought was, at least back then, is that his death was on March 25th. Now, that is reasonable. I don't know that it was March 25th. Some people argue for March 25th. Other people argue for April 2nd, early April. But it's going to be somewhere in that time span. And that coincides with Passover, and early Christian tradition had it as March 25th, or at least that was circulated. Well, if Christ's death marked the completion of his redemptive work, then it would stand to reason that his conception, the beginning of the work of his redemption, happened on the same calendar date. And so that it kind of signified this sort of theological symmetry rather than historical precision, okay? Now, I know you're going, wait, how could you think that? I get it. Because I was thinking that too. As I'm reading this, I'm going, what? Why would you? That seems weird. Well, it's interesting that you would ask that question, Shannon. How would you? But this is part of the reason why they're thinking that God is pointing to Christ as a significant figure and demonstrating that in the calendar, is because working from one faulty premise, which we'll see in just a second, you can start to deduce a date very close to March 25th as his date of conception. So you start to go, well, look at this. There is some symmetry between when he was conceived and when he died. So it's God kind of pointing to the calendar as saying this is really significant. Now, for us, okay, let me just back up for just a second. For us, the calendar is mostly not important except to hold all of our doctor's appointments and to give us notifications about different things. That is very much not the case for first century people, all right? These are people that navigate by the stars. The calendar is incredibly significant. In fact, the difference between the Pharisees and the Essenes. The Pharisees, remember, were a conservative group. They believed the entire Old Testament. We've been through this a lot, but I'll remind you. They believed the entire Old Testament. Sadducees, only the first five books. They were more the, if I can use this term, more the liberal group, all right, in Judaism. The Pharisees were the much more conservative group. They represented a lot of Judea. They represented a lot of the Jews, even though the political elites, the ruling class, was mostly the liberal Sadducees, all right? More liberal Sadducees. The Essenes were so conservative, they made the Pharisees look liberal, all right? And the reason the Essenes split from the Pharisees was over a calendar issue. Was over which calendar they used. So the Essenes used a calendar that was much more in favor of like a lunar kind of calendar, whereas the Pharisees sought a more progressive calendar. And to the Essenes, they thought, that is anathema. God has designed the universe and the stars to move in such a way that would give, that's all centered around our feasts and festivals of Judaism. And so if you want to go to this more progressive calendar, you're basically denying Judaism altogether. And so by the calendar that they're using also relates to the movement of the stars in the sky, right? So that all that's to say the calendar is really important for them, all right? And so I'm saying that they're looking at the calendar as God having a kind of a symmetry, pointing out significant characters by symmetry. They're saying probably something more like what the Magi say: we saw his star in the sky and we've come to worship him, right? It's important to them. And they're saying God is signifying there's a coming Messiah here. He's conceived. He's coming. He's telling the world this. And he tells them through the calendar and the stars. They're related together. Does that make a little more sense? Okay, you feel a little bit more easy about it. Okay, good. So, let's say you have that premise, that you think there's some calendar symmetry with the stars and the calendar, all that kind of stuff, between this significant event. Well, then, John Chrysostom, has anybody ever heard of John Chrysostom? Hey, Jeremy has, our recent graduate from seminary. Hello, well, Mr. Hudson. Straightens tie, adjusts pin in pocket. John Chrysostom was a pastor in the early 4th century, so the early to mid 4th century. That would be 300s AD. And he actually preaches a sermon that we have. This is a great thing. John Chrysostom was a podcaster. He podcasts all his sermons. We have them. They're all written down, or a lot of them anyway. And we have one particular sermon that he preached in Antioch in the year 3, what did I say? I have it written down here somewhere. What is it? 386. December 25th, 386 AD in Antioch. That would be of Syria. That's the Antioch of Acts 11, the big, you know, where they were first called Christians, that Antioch. He preaches a sermon, and he says, we can figure this out in Scripture when Christ was conceived. And therefore, we can figure out from Scripture when he was born. And he does that by looking at Zechariah, who is in the temple, serving in the temple on the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement would have been late September, early October. So somewhere in there, Zechariah serving in the temple. And we get this in Luke 1, 8 to 11. Now while he was serving as a priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense, and there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. Okay, so here is Zechariah. This is he's well into his, whatever, old age, past the point where he and his wife can have kids. And wouldn't you know it, his number comes up. Not only is the division of his little clan of the tribe of Levi drawn, but then he is drawn. This is like winning the lottery, essentially. This is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, okay? And on the day, his one time, probably in his entire life, to do this task, the Lord waits till that moment to give him the most important news of his life, that his wife's going to have a kid. So he's in there. Gabriel appears to him. You probably know the story by now. He sort of doubts this is going to happen. Gabriel says, I'm Gabriel. I stand at the right hand of God. Makes him mute. He leaves there. It says, When his time of service ended, this is verse 23, he went home. After these days, his wife conceived, and for 5 months she kept herself hidden. Okay? Then in 26, in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth. What is he going to do there? He's going to tell Mary, there's a baby in your womb. So we know Mary conceived 6 months from Elizabeth's date of conception, which was sometime in proximity, according to John Chrysostom, to the Day of Atonement, September, October. 6 months later would be essentially March. We know he died. John Chrysostom's arguing. We know he died March 25th. So he was also conceived in late March. Could it be the 25th? Well, a significant figure in history like Jesus? Maybe so. Now, can you point to John Chrysostom's major error here? Anything? Not Jeremy, obviously, because he graduated from seminary. That's cheating. Do you see in there anything that you're like, okay, John, I have a question. And this is a major error. Anything do you think is like a red flag? A little exercise? Oh, I see some investigating faces. Any thoughts? I'm going to let it hang out in the air here for just a minute. See. What do you think? What might be his error? Okay, there's obviously we don't know that it was on the 25th, right? Okay, fine. There's a bigger error than that. Do you see in Luke's narrative the Day of Atonement? Do you see that there? In anything we read in Luke, do you see the Day of Atonement being listed? You don't, do you? Who goes into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement? The high priest, and only the high priest. Where is, I didn't read this part, but where is Zechariah serving? Is he in the Holy of Holies? Where is he? Uh-huh. Is he in the Holy of Holies by the Ark of the Covenant? He's there by the altar of incense. The altar of incense is in the holy place. John Chrysostom assumes that because Zechariah is in the temple, serving in the temple, that he's serving as high priest on the Day of Atonement. But he's not. The priest had a lot of obligations. And some of those obligations were things like keeping the temple furniture and the altar of incense and the candles and all of those things, keeping them up to snuff, replacing the bread, doing those kinds of things. Zechariah is doing that. And the way they got those jobs is on a rotation. Basically, it just rotated through the different clans within the tribe of Israel. And his was, I think it was, the eighth clan. And so it would stand to reason that there was probably an eight or so week rotation during the times of service on either one of the feast festival sections of the year. So in the Jewish calendar, that would be like September, October, all the way into November and even December. And then there would be a time in the spring, too, where they would have these sort of feasts and festivals and things like that, where the rotations would be required. So he's on one of those rotations, serving inside the temple, basically serving by the altar of incense, offering incense. He could be doing any number of things inside the holy place. The point is, the Day of Atonement is not the one in view, right? On the Day of Atonement, that's the high priest's job to do that on behalf of the nation, not Zechariah, and he's not high priest at the time, okay? But beside that, that's not even really the point. I just want us to kind of be on the same page. John Chrysostom is saying he's tracing the sequence from the Day of Atonement through Elizabeth's conception to Mary's conception, and saying from the Day of Atonement, it was 6 months later, putting it in late March when Mary conceived, which would mean that the birth of Christ then another 9 months later would take place, not March 25th, but now December 25th. All right? You following the kind of patterns here? Kind of the logic? Okay. So his calculation puts Christ's birth, Mary's conception, Christ's birth in late December, providing this sort of theological rationale for celebrating the Nativity on December 25th. So, why is that important? This is John Chrysostom preaching a sermon explaining to a church in Antioch on Christmas Day why we celebrate Christmas on December 25th. The incarnation of Christ. Why do we celebrate that on December 25th? And he's explaining it. Here's why that's important. Because in his sermon, he does not relate the celebration of Christmas to the pagans in any way. He actually explains it from a theological background. Here is why we know Christ was born on December 25th. Now, if you were to ask me, I'm saying that like I'm John Chrysostom, by the way. If the puzzled look... Right. So I'm saying, regardless of whether he was right or wrong, that's the way he's arguing. We celebrated on December 25th because he was born on December 25th. That's what he's saying. Does that make sense? Yeah. No. So, if we were to kind of estimate maybe what time he was actually born, we would probably end up with a date either sometime around September, like August, September, or perhaps the beginning of the spring, maybe like April, May. But that's based on the same chronology, but just adjusting the time of Zechariah's service. So it'd probably be something more like that. But who wants to have Christmas in September? just kidding. You can't have a white Christmas in September. John Chrysostom, he was a pastor in the 300s. Well, yes, John Chrysostom. So that's a good question. What makes John Chrysostom so big of a deal that he's doing this? First of all, John Chrysostom is a pastor that not only preached faithfully, but suffered for preaching a good bit. Most of his sermons, well, I don't know how many sermons he preached, but we have a lot of them. And he's kind of revered as, you know, an early preacher. Just an early preacher of the gospel. And it's more than anything, I'm bringing him up to say this was the reflection of Christians of the time. 386 A.D. Yeah. So he preached that sermon December 25th, 386 A.D. in Antioch. And it was specifically on, not only was it on Christmas Day, but it was, the subject was the Nativity itself. And that being around the time, we also have this calendar reflecting the Nativity on the 25th. Chrysostom is reflecting this kind of spread of Christmas that's happening throughout the churches, and explaining that its origin, they're rooting it in theology. Even if they're, we would say his reading of the passage or his interpretation of Zechariah in the temple was not correct. His starting point was not correct. His logic is what we're pointing at. The reason he got there was because he's going through the Bible to get there, right? He's not saying, look, we're appealing to the masses, and the masses celebrate this pagan holiday on December 25th, which was celebrated in Rome only and not around the rest of the world. And yet the rest of the world is picking up December 25th. Why? Because of this argumentation that this is the birth of Christ, and we're celebrating the birth of Christ then. And so the importance is to say, where was the origin? Why did they start celebrating in December in the first place? And the answer is, best we can tell, based on the logic of John Chrysostom, it's because they're reading their Bibles and they're trying to come to that conclusion. They're trying their best to pin the date of when Christ was actually born and celebrate that day, right? So he's not making a pagan analogy or anything like that, or not arguing for that anyway. And when in the sermon, he not only argues for the celebration of the day when Christ was born based on when he was actually born, but he tells them, and this is the tradition we've received. So he's not just pointing to his own generation having created this holiday, but that people before him, his predecessors, pastors long before, have handed this day down as the birth date of Christ, which is why we celebrate it here. So does that make sense? This is part of received tradition. So could Christmas, December 25th, be the result of some pagan holiday that was transitioned over? I mean, it could be. Here's the point. We have no evidence for that at all. And we have all the evidence for Christians actually trying to pinpoint the day when Christ was born. Erroneously, but still trying. The heart was, that's right, it's the heart, it's the thought that counts, you know, that kind of thing. But then we get to this, like, this kind of Christmas tree tradition. And where did it actually come from? And some people argue that it came from, you know, another pagan tradition of celebrating, having a tree and all this kind of stuff, the evergreen tree. But actually we see the origin of the Christmas tree sometime within late medieval Christian culture rather than something ancient and pagan. It seems that the reason Christians started doing this, cutting down a tree, bringing it inside their house, actually started in Germany with these plays called Paradise Plays. And these would be kind of like entertainment sort of plays, but they would be sort of like, they would take place largely at Christmas time or around Christmas time. But they would be kind of a story of the Bible play. And these trees, they would decorate with fruit. And they called them paradise trees, and they were designed to depict the tree of life. And it would be sort of the story of the Bible, where they would have the tree decorated with fruit, and then it would appear throughout the play, and then at the beginning, and then at the end, when heaven is there, the new earth is there, and the tree of life is there again with fruit yielding every season that people could eat from and celebrate. There's another kind of legend. I don't know how true this is, but there's a rumor that Martin Luther has a little bit to do with the Christmas tree coming into the house, and that it was that he had seen this sort of tree in a snowy embankment, the pine tree, and kind of lit and all this kind of stuff. And so he started bringing it into the house, a celebration. But I couldn't really find much more evidence than that for that. But it seemed to be correlated to Christmas because as Christians were celebrating the birth of Christ, they were incorporating other traditions. And it seems like in Germany, they were depicting this sort of tree of life being the beginning and the end of the Bible, sort of depicting the story of the salvation of humanity from Christ as this tree of life. So then, what about, where does Santa Claus come from? Now, I've got some caveats on this one. All right, so hang with me. There was a bishop in the 4th century, around the same time of John Chrysostom, named Nicholas of Myra. He was a bishop of Myra. His name was Nicholas. And that's in kind of modern-day Turkey. And he had this reputation for being really generous with the poor, and apparently sailors, too. He had a particular ministry with sailors and sought to share the gospel with them a lot and things like that. But he also did a lot of charitable giving to, particularly to children. And so Nicholas of Myra, believe it or not, actually appears in some of the lists of the Council of Nicaea. Nicaea, you may remember the Nicene Creed and the creed that comes out of that. That creed is actually intended to go after Arianism, which is a false doctrine. And Nicholas of Myra is one of the bishops at that time who apparently appears on some of these lists as being present during the Council of Nicaea. And there's even a legend that's made its way around that at some point in the debate between the bishops and Arius, who's promoting Arianism, this heresy that Christ was not the eternal Son of God but was adopted, that at some point in the process, Nicholas of Myra punches Arius in the face. And so there's this sort of urban legend about Santa Claus, Saint Nick, punching Arius in the face. Anyway, so the legend of Saint Nicholas grew from this bishop early on, who was known for his, ironically known, even though he was secretively giving, it became known that he was the one doing the secret giving. And the reason that he did that is because he considered his reward to be in heaven. Now, let me put a caveat on this real quick, okay? Because I knew this was going to maybe draw some eyebrows. We were very particular when it came to Christmas about what we did and did not say to our children. We actually, and I every time I counsel parents as they're raising kids and stuff like this, I tell them, look, just be very honest with your kids about where those presents come from, all right? Now, here's the reason why. I tell them the gospel. God took on flesh to dwell with us, to die on the cross and rise on the third day. I don't ever want them to be confused when I tell them a story, whether it's true or not. And when I put presents under the tree, and Andrea and I buy all these presents, wrap them, and give them to our kids, I am not going to let some mythological fat man take credit for that. No. No, I'm teasing. I say that in jest. I'm joking. But in all seriousness, we told our kids very early on, it's a story. It's a story from the culture like any other story. You know, Rudolph would be along the same lines as similar stories that they're fun. You'll see them on commercials and you do all these kinds of things, but they're not true. You know, we watch a lot of movies that are stories. They're not true stories. And we were very clear about that early on, but this that I'm telling you about Christ is true. And as much as we could take the Christmas picture, the holiday, and shift the cultural focus from Santa Claus to Christ, we were going to do that. And I would advise any parent to do that. We don't venerate Santa Claus or anything like that. However, I do think if we look back at where those legends eventually came from, at the heart of it is a Christian message about giving and gift giving, and that its origin really lies with a Christian pastor who wanted to give gifts to poor children and do it even secretively. No red suit, no fat belly. I don't know how fat he was, but certainly wasn't an elf. To give gifts charitably to poor children. And I think that message, now the urban legends that grow out of that, you know, whatever, it is what it is, but its origin is really distinctively Christian. And as much as we can shift it away from that, I think the better. So I think all of that's to say is not to say, hey, therefore, you know, do everything with Christmas and, yeah, celebrate Santa Claus and all that kind of stuff. But it is to say, when it comes to the question of is it Christian or pagan, it seems like at least at its root, it's Christian. Now, it can become pagan really quick, can it? Very quickly. It certainly can. But there's another more subtle point that I think ties us together, which hopefully will bring this home. Maybe it won't. Maybe only in my head it does. That is these magi that we see in Matthew chapter 2. Why don't I read this out of Matthew 2? I'm just going to read the whole thing. It's only 12 verses. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh, and being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." Matthew's, first of all, these magi, probably the origin for the magi best fits with a group of people in Babylon or the surrounding area. We actually see them come up first on the scene in Daniel. Anybody remember this? Daniel is brought before King Nebuchadnezzar, told to interpret his dream, tell him what the dream is. And it's the magi in Babylon who cannot ascertain his dream. They don't know what it is. Daniel, of course, does. He confronts these magi on several occasions. Now, some people, when they hear magi, they'll think magician, like somebody who does card tricks or something, devilish kind of practices. But while that may be a small percentage of it, I don't know. but it's certainly not mainly what they're thought of. They're thought of as the brightest minds, the scholars. We might consider them today, in our day and age, something like, you know, professors, you know, or something like that, doctorates. They've got PhDs, you know, the most highly educated and things like that. And who is put over the Magi in Daniel? Do you remember? It's Daniel, yeah. Yeah. Daniel is put over the Magi. So it seems as though when Matthew says the Magi were coming from the east, it's probably at least in that region that they're coming from, Babylon. There are some people who want to make this a different group of people, and I see no evidence for that. I see it mostly coming probably from Babylon. And they're really the smarty pants of the nation is essentially who they are. What's interesting though is that they discern the birth of a king through a star. Again, like I said, the stars were not just, this is not not probably the same thing as we would think of as people that look at the stars today. You know, that look at different like astrological signs. It's certainly a more pagan practice to like think that maybe God is talking to you through the stars, I guess. Or that fate is determined by the stars. That's certainly a pagan practice. And actually condemned in the Old Testament. And these are certainly pagans, that's for sure. But at the same time, they're also looking and they're essentially interpreting a message that they believe to be from God. What I think is interesting about that is that these are pagans, not Jewish, certainly not Christian yet, who are being given a true message that seems to be from God Himself, drawing these men through Jerusalem as a warning to Herod and to venerate, to revere the Christ child that's being born. So Matthew, in his gospel, does not condone the practice of astrology at all. He's not advocating you go out and look at the stars, because that's condemned in Judaism. You're not to do that. But even still, God is reaching through pagan means to reach Gentiles who would otherwise have no access to the Christ child to tell them, my son is being born. He does the same thing to the shepherds in Luke. Shepherds are not great people. They're the lowest of the low in society, just slightly above tax collector. And those are the ones he goes out to tell, go worship my son. So he's reaching out to a lot of people through means you and I would not advocate they practice, to reach them, to bring them to Christ. Very strange, isn't it? It's odd. So in this story, Matthew is highlighting a really important point about the incarnation itself. The Magi, who are pagan, who are following stars, are acting decisively on limited revelation, and they're journeying to honor this newborn king, not the one who is born to be king of the Jews, but the one who is born king. They assume he's going to be in Jerusalem, because that's where the stars are pointing them to. And if you know the geography, Bethlehem is just beyond Jerusalem, just just a few miles. And so when they're coming from the east, they're going straight through Jerusalem in line with this star. Now, does the star come down in the form of like sitting on top of the house like this, or are they just navigating by the stars? I couldn't tell you. The text could support either one of those. But the point is they're lining it up and they're going, and they assume Jerusalem, since it is the capital city and it's where King Herod lives, that this must be King Herod's child. And so when they go, they assume Herod has had this new baby. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. And so they determine through scholars and things like that in Jerusalem that he's in Bethlehem. What's also interesting about that is that you notice in verse 3 of chapter 2, it says, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. What's the next line? The next phrase? And all Jerusalem with him. Pagans. Practicing pagan rituals seem to receive a message from God specifically about the birth of his son. And so they come to worship this one who's been born king. And the Jews, who are supposed to be receiving the Messiah with joy, are troubled because the king that they actually serve is troubled. So in their estimation, which is of greater concern? The birth of the Messiah or the fact that Herod is disturbed? To them, it's of greater concern that Herod is disturbed. Pagans seem to receive the message that all of Judea does not. So I think there's a really important thing to sort of emphasize here, what Christmas is and is not. I don't think that it has pagan origins. I think that it has largely Christian origins. I think that it, in many ways, has become pagan now. But I think its origin is Christian. But what I think it underscores as we see the story of the incarnation of Christ develop is that this is good news targeted to outsiders. I don't think it's pagan, but I think it's for pagans. The message of the incarnation of Christ that we celebrate at Christmas is good news for people who don't believe. It's them that need to hear it. It's not only us. We need to be reminded of it too. But it is for them too, to hear what it actually means, what the Nativity really is about, why this day that we celebrate, even if the date is wrong, is the second most important day in human history. Might argue that most important, because the most important one couldn't have happened without this one. Between Christmas and Easter, it's right for the church to turn its attention to the incarnation, to the death and resurrection of Christ on Easter. Because this is news that the world is prone to forget. The more Christmas and the more we turn Christmas into this sort of pagan holiday that it's become and lose sight of its original intention, the more the world is totally lost in the message. Does that make sense? That's why I think it's so important for parents, develop your traditions at Christmas time and Easter for that matter, or I prefer to call it Resurrection Sunday, but you get the idea. It's so important for you to develop those traditions around the birth of Christ, because it continues to put that season in focus for your children. Also, everyone you interact with. It shifts the focus away from all of the gift-giving and the Santa Claus and the elf on the shelf and all this other nonsense that it has become, to shift it back to its original intention. God is reaching out to the lost. He's coming to seek and to save pagans. Didn't start pagan. It can become pagan. But its original message is for pagans. It's for people who have never heard. Questions? Comments? Thoughts? So Kathy asked about, don't we know when Herod was collecting taxes? And can't we ascertain the date from there? There's an issue that's in Luke, and it's actually all of Rome, and it comes from Caesar Augustus. He's the one that starts the census to collect taxes. Luke tells us in your text, in the ESV, it will say, while Quirinius was governor. The problem with that translation is that Quirinius was governor in like 6 AD, and Herod died in 4 BC. So, what do we do with that? And I think the understanding should be Quirinius did do a census in his day. We know that. But that verse could also be translated before Quirinius was governor. In other words, Luke is saying this was a census, but not the one you're thinking about. This was one that was done before Quirinius was governor. That being said, because it's a lesser known census that took place for tax purposes, I don't think we know the actual date when it took place. Plus, a census would have been over, like it is now, it's over the course of like a year or whatever. They kind of prepare for it for a decade and then do it for a year. In a similar way, it was done over a longer period of time. People had to travel to their home cities where their heritage was. And so, All that to say, we don't know the exact time. We can get reasonably close, but we can also do it through the way Zechariah to Elizabeth to Mary, and then kind of determine it's going to be one of these two sets of months. We probably can't make it more precise than that. Good question. Good observation. Other questions? Any of you go, well, that was useless. Why did I come tonight? I hope not. I don't know. I think it's to me, a lot of the historical evidence is you can kind of see where we've covered over it, you know, with a lot of pagan influence, to be honest with you. There's been a lot of pagan influence that has really covered over Christmas. And I think all of us as Christians are probably tempted in one way or another to go back, to go into those pagan influences and celebrate those and find a lot of joy in those. But I think the more you kind of, you know, blow the dust off of all the pagan stuff, you actually uncover some roots in there that, you know, are really kind of deep and rich that the church has been doing for a long time, you know. And honestly, it doesn't matter to me one way or another if Christians back in the 300s had, you know, said, well, they do a holiday around December. Why can't we do a holiday around December and started doing their own thing? I wouldn't really care one way or another. I think it's a good thing that we focus our attention on the incarnation of Christ, and especially when the culture is more apt to hear a message of the incarnation. And we routinely have people in here on our Christmas Eve service that don't normally go to church, but they'll come to a Christmas Eve service. And, you know, that's an amazing time. And what we do every year, I don't know how many of you have been to our Christmas, I'm sure most of you have, but our Christmas Eve service, we go through the same story every time. It's something that I wrote, but I just walk through the message of the, we read the whole Christmas story essentially. We sing songs in between it. Kids can come and it's fine, everybody's okay. There's a lot of singing and, you know, little storytelling in between, and we just focus on the message of the incarnation, and it's a great time for people to just hear it who have never heard it before. And we do the same thing at Easter, and I think that's a good thing for the church to do. So for us, I want us to kind of always around December focus again on the incarnation. Not that we don't normally, but just, you know, focus in particular on the incarnation. And around Easter, I want us to build, you know, the entire weekend for the Easter message, to kind of really preach the gospel and the resurrection of Christ. I think it's the least that we can do. I'm not overly calendar driven on anything else, but on those, I think it's good to focus on it. Yeah. That's good. I think it's helpful too. You know, with your Christmas tree, maybe it'll take on a new meaning to you to kind of look at it like the tree of life that I'm bringing in here is like, this is the tree of life in the garden, the tree of life in the resurrection, and here's all the ornate decoration on it is kind of a symbol of life to come. Lucas, do you have a question? Oh, okay. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we're grateful for a time to come together and really to think through history, and I pray that it's of some benefit and some use to us, that it might bless people or really just give us maybe a new perspective on Christmas. We pray that you would use it in whatever way you see fit in the lives of our people. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening. If you live in the Tuscaloosa area and are looking for a church, we'd love for you to visit. Our service times are Sunday mornings at 10:30 and Wednesday nights at 6:15.